Welcome back to New Books in Religion. Thanks again for joining us. I'm your host, Christian Peterson. Today I have the pleasure of speaking with Kevin Shelbrack about his great new book, Philosophy and the Study of Religions, A Manifesto, which was published by Wiley Blackwell in 2014. Very often, evaluative questions about cultural phenomena are avoided for more descriptive or explanatory goals when approaching religions. Traditionally, this set of concerns has been left to philosophers of religion. In this great new book, Kevin Shelbrack argues that the philosophical approaches to the study of religion plays a central role in our understanding of both religious communities and the discipline of religious studies. This book offers a critique of what Shelbrack calls traditional philosophy of religion, characterized as narrow, intellectualist, and insular, and a toolkit for achieving a global, practice-centered, and reflexive philosophical approach. With our wide-ranging goals in sight, we are offered a new definition of religion that points us in a common direction for analyzing social data. Ultimately, Shelbrack positions his new evaluative approach as one branch in a tripartite methodology, complementing more dominant descriptive and explanatory approaches. Overall, this book looks to the future of the field and offers interesting directions for others to follow. In our conversation, we discuss religious practice, cognition, belief, embodiment, conceptual metaphors, definitional boundaries, super-empirical realities, and the ontology of religion, among many, many other things. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Kevin Shelbrack. Thanks again for listening to New Books in Religion. Welcome. This morning I have the pleasure of speaking with Kevin Shelbrack about his great new book, Philosophy and the Study of Religions, A Manifesto. Good morning, Kevin. How are you?
Hi, Christian. Thanks for talking to me.
Yeah, thanks for making the time to talk to me about this great book. As someone who's not well-versed in the philosophy of religions, this was a great introduction and motivation to delve further into it. So I'm really excited to talk to you about it. Before we get into what you're doing, which is some really exciting challenges for the field, I was hoping you could kind of let us know a little bit about yourself, how you got interested in the study of religions, perhaps people that have been influential in your approach, or how you got hooked.
That's a good question. I think I have a path that is similar to other people who are interested in the philosophical or the theological or the normative side of religious studies. I'm the kind of person who was always animated by the existential questions and arrived in college with that kind of introspective and maybe ethical set of questions about who I am and what I owe to other people and what makes the right action, those kinds of philosophical questions. And that was nurtured in college. I went to Rollins College in Central Florida and had good liberal arts teachers there who nurtured those kinds of questions. And I think I could have easily gone to graduate school in philosophy as easily as religious studies. And it was my sense that the questions about virtue, the questions about selfhood, the questions about metaphysics that I had would find a better home in religious studies than they would in philosophy. I think in the 1980s in the Anglophone world, a lot of those questions were seen as passé in philosophy, and I worried that I wouldn't find a good grad school to work on them. But I was open to either one, and I ended up in religious studies and happily. And I applied to a bunch of places, but ended up at University of Chicago, which turned out to be a perfect place for me. Just as I got there, just as I was about to take my doctoral exams, they added a track in philosophy of religion at the University of Chicago Divinity School. I think the Divinity School is known for comparative religions, but that wasn't my track at all. And the people in comparative religions there tended not to be asking philosophical questions, and I was frustrated by that until they added that track. So I worked with Chris Gamwell, who does metaphysics, and Paul Griffiths, who does comparative philosophy of religion at Chicago, and it ended up being the perfect place for me. I caught that bug that people catch in graduate school about the excitement of their inquiries, and I still have it. What is it now? About 20 years later.
Yeah, that's great. And in the book, you mentioned that was a long time ago, but you did state that these people kind of place this kind of inquiry into this field in your research. So it's interesting to kind of hear that background. I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about how this book began to emerge from your kind of larger research trajectory. You've written a lot on various topics. So why this book? And it's I don't know if I want to say controversial, but it's definitely stirring the water. So why this type of book? Why a manifesto?
Well, maybe that question I can answer on two levels. One of them might be of interest to your listeners, just about getting published. And the other one is more directly focused on the question that you're asking about stirring the waters. So I got hired originally at a small liberal arts college that had heavy teaching expectations and minimal publication expectations. And I never felt that I had the time to devote to a book. And I didn't know if I was ever going to get a book written. Everything I wrote was articles, and I tried to engage the questions that mattered to me, and I was getting published, but I didn't have a monograph, and I didn't even know that I had one in me. And I was contacted by the editor at Blackwell, who had apparently come across some of those articles and thought that I was a clear writer and thought that I helped frame questions in a way that a broad readership could appreciate and get engaged in. And she invited me to write a manifesto out of the blue. I didn't approach them at all. And they have a series, a manifesto series with people in the humanities staking a position and arguing for a certain agenda in peace studies or Shakespeare or historiography. There's more than two dozen, maybe three dozen books in the series so far. And so this book was originally going to be called The Future of Philosophy of Religion. And it wasn't until it was in press that the title was changed to Philosophy and the Study of Religions with a Manifesto as the subtitle that kind of links it to the other books in their series. So that's the general question. But once I had accepted the contract to write this book for Blackwell, I had so much freedom in order to pick the topics that were in the book. And in some ways, I think I did not do a good job of that. And by that, I mean that for those who've seen the book, there's one chapter, for example, on practice and performance and embodiment. And I had to do my best to get a hold on the literature in that subfield. And once that chapter was finished, then I had another chapter on philosophy of mind and belief and disposition. And so I had to set down that pile of books that I'd worked through to do the performance chapter and pick up another chapter on cognition, pick up another set of books on cognition. And once that one was done, there's another chapter on realism and metaphysics and reference. And so every chapter is on a different set of questions. It was exhausting, to be honest. I felt that I was never able to finish one chapter and then, you know, turn the page, so to speak, and just start writing the next one. I had to do more research for each one. I hope that makes the book engaging. I hope that the people who read the book, therefore, feel that they are walked through a set of questions that are all different and interesting and provocative, but it's a difficult way to write a book. Now when I pick up other people's books, I see that the whole book is on Schleiermacher.
Right.
Whatever it is. And then I think that would be an easier book to write and a smarter book to write. But it's not the way I did this one.
Yeah. Well, we appreciate all your effort, because I think this this book definitely does walk us through an interesting set of questions. One other thing I want to ask you about kind of the writing process and the way you wrote the book was you wrote at the end of each chapter what you call bibliographic essays. I'm wondering if you could talk about what made you approach your sources in this way, perhaps what your intention was behind these. I found them very helpful and much more interesting than reading a list of sources.
Yeah, that was a decision made awkwardly, mostly by the publisher, but I'm happy with the result. I mean, the situation is this: they wanted a manifesto that didn't have footnotes. They wanted a manifesto that was speaking, you might say, in the first person, where you say, "I believe this, and I think that we should do that," and I like that idea for a book, but I didn't want to write a book without footnotes.
Right.
Well, partly, you know, because like lots of scholars, I find them important, but also it's my first book, and I thought it's going to be strange if I'm pontificating to the academy. With no reference to what anybody else has ever thought. And so I wrote the papers as if they were traditional scholarship, not for the manifesto. And then I had to find a way to fit them into the manifesto. So what I did was I removed 90% of the footnotes and moved them all into those bibliographic essays. So instead of having footnotes that would distract from the reading of the chapter, and I think that the publisher was right that a manifesto shouldn't have those, but it also might be true that undergraduates are not especially interested in the minutia of the different schools of thought about some question and so forth. And so it's fine, I think, to have removed them from the bottom of the page and move them back to the end of the chapter so that someone can just read the chapter straight through and think about the questions that I'm talking about and not care about who said what. Or what's the state of the discipline in whatever field? But then, if a person is interested in that, and like you said, someone can go back and read the bibliographic essay, and hopefully get a nice picture of what the positions are and why they've been taken and who stands for what. So yeah. It was a compromise, but I'm happy with the end result. I actually submitted to them one bibliographic essay at the end of the entire book, broken up into chapter sections, and they re-separated those and moved them to the end of each chapter, which I thought Blackwell did a lot of smart things with the book, and I'm really happy with the work they did that we did together.
Yeah, I think it really came out great, and those are very helpful for people that do want to go further into this. You really kind of outline the debate for them. So much of your critique is against what you call traditional philosophy of religion. For those of us that are not in the know, can you kind of walk us through what is this? What is traditional philosophy of religion? How does it work? What are they trying to do?
Traditional philosophy of religion, I think you can sum up, or I sum up in the book, just as the rationality of theism. So traditional philosophy of religion is the philosophical work that people do when they're reflecting on what is God like, how can I make sense of omniscience or omnipotence? How could there be a God that has those kinds of omni powers given the evil that we see in the world or the amount of evil that we see in the world? Can I prove that there is such a God? Those, I think, are the traditional philosophical philosophy of religion questions since David Hume, let's say, for about the last 200 years. I'm not a hater. I think they're good questions, and they're the questions that drew me into the field. I want to say more about traditional philosophy of religion, but I commented earlier that The Future of Philosophy of Religion was the original title of the book, and it got changed to Philosophy and the Study of Religions precisely because, although the book opens with a critique of traditional philosophy of religion, and it's being read by some traditional philosophers of religion as a critique of them, the book has a far broader audience, and I'm hoping that people who are not in philosophy of religion will pick up the book and say, well, I wonder how philosophy connects to other things that in the field. And so I'm happier with the vaguer title that it has now. I think, or maybe I should say more inclusive title that it has now. One more word though about traditional philosophy of religion. I think the trajectory of philosophy of religion is interesting. And what I'm about to say is not in the book, but it lies behind my motivation for writing the book. I think that as in the Enlightenment, as European intellectuals began to be critical publicly of Christian doctrine and started to ask the questions that I just listed, how could a God do this? What about evil? Can there be proofs for the existence of God, especially after the scientific revolution? Those are the questions that people see in Hume and in Hegel and in Kant and in Kierkegaard and so forth. But that's a long time ago in my mind. And by the time you reach the 20th century, I feel that the study of religions as a global discipline is really exploding. And the giants of sociology of religion, the giants of anthropology of religion, the giants of comparative religions, they're struggling in the 20th century, especially after World War II, especially after the return of religion, quote unquote. They're struggling to master a deluge of data. And when you turn from the study of religions broadly with that deluge of data to philosophy of religion, you don't see the same thing. There's only a few philosophers of religion who are trying to rethink the concept of religion so that it's more inclusive, trying to understand how justification works outside of a theistic framework. And really in the last, say, roughly since 1980, I think philosophers of religion have actually retreated from the diversity of religions in the world. Their argument goes something like this. There are no, given the collapse of foundationalism in philosophy, given the sense that there's no neutral criteria, given the sense that there's no standards of rationality that are universal that we can just appeal to and say, now I can show you that this religion is better than that religion. If that's not possible, then philosophers of religion who emerge from a sectarian commitment or from a sectarian community, they despair of engaging religions outside their own. And they think more in a silo where they say something like this: I myself or the people in my community, we take this scripture to be foundational for us, or we take some religious experience to be basic for us. And there's no way for us to convince anybody else that the scripture is right or that that experience is right. And so we're not even going to try. So our only task as philosophers of religion is to clarify what it means to be a member of this particular community. And so at the same time that I see religious studies opening up and becoming more inclusive, I see philosophers of religion, for the most part, giving up on that global project. And so the book was designed to build a bridge between those two communities so that religious studies people who are interested in philosophical questions could see how they might engage them, and philosophers of religion who wanted to take seriously that explosion of information that we have about people of Africa, people of South America, people of South Asia, just religions all around the world, would also find a bridge going in the opposite direction.
Now, just to kind of catch listeners up, I guess probably your ultimate goal here is to create a global practice center and reflexive philosophy of religion, which in your discussion of traditional philosophy of religion, you argue that the state now is it's generally narrow, intellectualist, and insular. So, and this comes out in some of the following chapters. So perhaps we could start with religious practice since you have a whole chapter on this. Why has there been a hesitation to explore religious practice in the philosophy of religion, and how should we kind of approach it, do you think?
The first thing to note, I think, is that there has been a kind of division of labor. And if under the category of religious practice you include ritual and ceremony and performance and worship and sacrifice. Those are questions that you're not going to find in any philosophy of religion book. You do find them, obviously, in anthropology of religion books or sociology of religion books. And so I think, I think there's a kind of unspoken division of labor where philosophers see themselves as dealing with the cognitive aspects of religion, which they take it are found in religious doctrines, or maybe you'd say in religious intellectuals, in religious texts sometimes. But the embodied parts, the lived parts of religion, the performed parts of religion, they leave to the side for anthropologists and sociologists and other social scientists, for historians of religion to study. I mean, just if you look at the different journals, if you look at a philosophy of religion journal and you look for anything at all on performance or practice or ceremony or ritual, there's almost nothing. You find the occasional paper on prayer, but that's it. Again, as I said before, reflecting the rationality of theism that defines the traditional philosophy of religion task. But if you open up the journal Religion or the History of Religions or journals that have a more social scientific bent, there's a wealth of information about performance, practice, ceremony, and ritual. So I think that division is kind of this weird mind-body split, this kind of Cartesian split in our field. And so the chapter that you're referring to in my book about practice, I just started to think, what could a philosopher of religion do if she wanted to take practice seriously or to take ritual seriously? Should I go into the details of that chapter?
If you'd like. I mean, I think you're offering some interesting ways of getting at that, I think.
Yeah.
So you offer us a toolkit, right, with various, levels of approaching practice. Maybe you could mention that a little bit.
Well, for me, it isn't enough to just say, look, philosophers of religion have not looked at practice, and they ought to look at practice. They ought to read social scientific reports about rituals and so forth. The rituals and religious practices generally will only be of interest and should only be of interest to philosophers if there's something philosophically relevant about them. And so the question for me is, are the practices events or opportunities or situations in which the practitioners do something philosophical, in which they inquire into the world or they learn something about the world, or they have a hypothesis that they test in the world. And if they don't, then the philosophers are not wrong to just leave rituals for the social scientist. But then I think that maybe what I just said is a good way of thinking about the question that has been assumed, and that is that rituals are thoughtless. Rituals are not cognitive forms of inquiry. They're not explorations of the world. They are mechanical, repetitious, or they're rote. And if that's the assumption, and I don't know how to prove something like that, but that seems to be a widespread assumption. But if that's the assumption, then you can see the extent to which philosophy of religion reflects a Protestant bias against the Judaic ritualizing or the Catholic ritualizing. It's a rejection of the value of religious work. And so I guess I'm undermining that. I spent a year at Harvard, actually, and Larry Sullivan was the director for the Center for the Study of World Religions at the time, and he made a list of the biggest names in ritual studies. Victor Turner and Catherine Bell and himself and I don't know, maybe a dozen people. All of them were Catholic or former Catholics, and I think that. The observation I'm making now, which is not exactly in the book, but the book springs from, is the sense to which Anglophone reflection on religion shows a Protestant bias against embodied practice. So that's what I'm trying to think against or think in opposition to. And you're right. So I've got a kind of a toolkit. There's a anthropologist that, whom I draw on who sees practice or sees embodiment as a way of being in the world. And I think Merleau-Ponty or perhaps to a secondary extent, Pierre Bourdieu are the theoretical backbone of his work. So I think that there's no reason why philosophers of religion cannot follow Thomas Chordas, the anthropologist I'm talking about, in adopting embodiment as a religious way of being in the world. And then that immediately opens up to them that whole set of philosophical tools that are widespread in philosophy, especially in continental philosophy, but rarely used among philosophers of religion, that have to do with studying the phenomenology of movement, of gesture, of being with other people, of physical transformations. So that's one of the tools in the toolkit, is that embodiment paradigm. Another one is conceptual metaphors show the ways that being in the world, that moving through the world helps people think, develops metaphors or analogies for more abstract ways of conceptualizing a person's life. The example I give in the book is moving from point A to point B, and the person thinks of that as a journey. They physically move from point A to point B, and that's how a person learns what a journey is. But then you can talk about the journey of my career or the journey of our marriage or the journey of writing this book, and you start to abstract from the physical domain a metaphor in order to conceptualize a more conceptual domain where the philosophers, are more comfortable. And then the third and the last of the tools in the toolkit has to do with cognitive prosthetics or physical tools that people have in their on their desk or at hand to help them do conceptual work. A classic example is just when you try to do math. You try to do math, let's say not 7 times 6, but a more complicated number. If you try to multiply a four-digit number times another four-digit number, most of us can do that on a piece of paper with a pencil. And so if you think of the paper and the pencil as a prosthetic device or as an extended tool in the world that helps the person do the conceptual work, the question then is whether the material culture of religious life, whether ritual implements also extend the cognitive ability of the mind in order to remember things that were taught before, in order to reinforce them, or in order to rearrange them so that the ideas that the religious practice is giving the practitioner are not merely quote unquote in their head, but they're in the temple or they're in the synagogue or they're in the church, physically available for the person to touch or handle or walk around and see, in order, like the tiles in a Scrabble game, to rearrange them and rearrange them and rearrange them until that person finds a way that they fit. Obviously, they're given a limited set of Scrabble tiles, quote unquote, depending on what community they're a part of, but then they can rearrange those tiles in order to find a way that fits for them, that's acceptable both to their community and connects to whatever it is the conceptual problem they're dealing with. I give an example of the station cross or the temple I saw in Thailand that had paintings on the wall of stories from the Ramayana. And the person can look at the stations of the cross or look at the pictures of the Ramayana and say, oh, there's an example of heroism, and here's an example of grief, and here's an example of kinship, and here's an example of romantic love. And they can look at these images, those are analogous to the Scrabble tiles, and pick which ones speak to their heart the most, or they think fit their circumstances the most. So that was my suggestion, was that in the same way that cognitive scientists see writing implements, artistic representations, mathematical tools like the paper and the pencil or a calculator, they see those as cognitive prosthetics that extend the ability of people to solve problems. Philosophers of religion and others could see material culture of a ritual environment in an analogous way.
And I think you make a very convincing argument here, and provided with the tools that you give us. Related to this is this idea of where then is belief. Belief has held a central role in the philosophy of religion. So in this next chapter, you basically outline various arguments or objections to focusing on belief. But then you kind of rethink what belief is and what we can get out of looking at it. Can you tell us a little bit about this discussion?
Yeah, I think this is a discussion that in some ways is of the seven chapters in the book, is somewhat basic. And in other ways, it's, I mean, in the sense that it, here, I'll give you an anecdote. I took that chapter and I sent it to a journal to see if they would publish it before it came out in the book. And I sent it to a philosophy journal. And as you say, the chapter describes ways in which theorists of religion have objected to the category of belief, and you find some people saying we shouldn't talk about belief anymore, or it's mistaken to think that religion is about belief, or that even the religious people have to have beliefs. And so I as you say, I outlined those problems at the beginning. And the journal mailed me back the paper, and they said it was a really clear paper and not a bad paper, but they couldn't understand how anyone would think that you can understand human activity without the concept of belief. They said that's the kind of thing that would only happen in religious studies, not in philosophy. And so in some ways they rejected the paper because they thought the problem was an artificial one. And I know what they mean, but I still think that in religious studies, and really not just in religious studies, but whenever you're trying to interpret intentional behavior on the part of somebody, I think we still have more work to do to figure out what can a person know of another when we're interpreting behavior. Can we say, oh, I saw their behavior, so I know what their beliefs are, to any extent? How divided are we in terms of understanding the structure of other people's behavior? In some ways, like I said, I thought that chapter was not reaching the level of complexity that philosophy journal wanted. But in other ways, I think it's a question that if other people just want to read that one chapter, I think it could be a springboard or a stepping stone to further work that has to do with interpretation of intentions by agents. And that seems to me non-eliminable from the study of religious practice, from the study of religious phenomena, and I think the field needs more help thinking about that, about the difference between internal perspectives and external perspectives, about the interpretation of behavior and the interpretation of linguistic behavior. What is presupposed when we interpret another person? What can we know and what can't we know? So that's a short version, but I'm happy about that chapter in the sense that when I finished it and that journal declined it, I thought, well, maybe this is too basic. But as I continue to read and basically in the year since I sent the manuscript into the publisher, I continue to see people struggling with this, theorists of religion struggling with these kinds of questions about agency and intention and subjectivity and experience. So I think the problem is definitely still with us.
in the next kind of couple of chapters, you deal with this idea of religion itself as a category. What is religion? And you start with this critique of religion, and you divide it into kind of a three-level critique, and kind of outline how someone might think about these critiques. So I'm wondering if you could kind of walk us through some of these arguments, right? So the idea that it's socially constructed, the idea that it distorts the reality that it describes. What are these critiques about, and then how can we respond to these?
You're right to see the next two chapters as kind of a pair in the book. The chapter four is about the ontology of the concept of religion. So what kind of reality does it have when you say there is a religion in Peru, let's say? So chapter four is about this question. Are we projecting the reality of religion out onto the world where it doesn't really have any purchase? Is it a Western concept? Is it a Christian concept that we're imposing on other people who wouldn't recognize it, and therefore it might be fair to say it's an imperialistic concept, or we're as you said, distorting the forms of life of people in the world in order to mold them into a Western or European perspective. That's what chapter four is about. And so the question is whether or not it's fair to say, or proper to say, or legitimate to say that religions are real, that there are religions out there, that if somebody doesn't use the concept of religion, whether we can say that they have a religion. That's chapter four. You asked me to walk through the arguments against the category of religion, and that was an exciting chapter for me to write, or a powerful chapter for me to write, precisely because I was so impressed by the critics of the concept of religion. So even though I'm a defender of it, and I distinguish basically between abolitionists who say we should get rid of the concept and retentionists like me who say that we should keep it, and I'm a retentionist, I was so impressed by the abolitionists. And I think pedagogically speaking, when you're in the classroom, to get students to see the way that our concepts have a history and that they do serve the purposes of the people who've developed those concepts as tools, that's a powerful pedagogical device. And to say, how could you sort out what people are doing without using the concept of religion, and to talk about some other kind of social formation or some other kind of ideology, that's a helpful thing for students to do. I think that chapter, again, you can lift the individual chapters out of the book, and I think that chapter could be paired with an essay by a critic of the concept of religion in a way that was pedagogically useful for the classroom. But despite the fact that I do think that religion is a category that was developed for Western purposes in the last few hundred years, I do think it's illuminating. I do think it's a useful concept. I do think it's not illegitimate to say that there are religions out there, even among people who don't use the concept. In this respect, it's similar to the word politics, or it's similar perhaps to the word sexism. If you say, oh, I think I see sexist phenomena or a pattern of behavior I would describe as sexist, it would not be an objection to say, yeah, but the person who's acting that way doesn't use that word, doesn't even know that word. The culture you're talking about would not describe itself as sexist. That doesn't mean that there's not sexism there. And so I think religion is analogous to that situation. That's chapter four. And chapter five, having defended the legitimacy of the category of religion, I then thought I needed to make a stab at defining what is, in my own judgment, the best way to define the term. What's the best way to define religion? So,
yeah, and if I could jump in here, so that's great. And I'm wondering if you could talk just before you maybe tell us what your you know, kind of limiting as religion. If you could talk about why you're attempting to define it, what's the purpose or the value of definition for you? You talk about it as a strategy, right? So what's the best way to approach this social phenomena that we're looking at, and why does a definition help us think about that?
Oh, well, you know, since I think it's legitimate, like I said, to use this concept, then I think there's a burden on people to define how they're using the terms. Here's an analogy that makes a lot of sense to me. I went out to dinner one time with a guy who was a friend of mine, and he said, we're on a date. And I said, well, I don't think we're on a date. And he said, but you called me and you picked me up and you're the one paying for dinner. So I think we are on a date. And so it's worth thinking about. People disagree about their definition of a date. If you define a date as a social event that might involve romance, then we were not on a date. But if you define a date as a social event where one person invites out another and pays for their dinner, then we were on a date. A date, like a religion, is a social construction in the sense that you can't look at what the people are doing and tell whether they're on a date. It's not determined by the events of what they're doing. You have to come up with a definition that makes sense to you, that helps you clarify what your social behavior means. So I think there are dates out there, given my definition, and I think there are religions out there, given my definition, but there's still an obligation on me to clarify the definition. And once you have a definition, if you say, this is how I define a date, and you share it with somebody else, you say, look at how this is the tool I want to use, it's fair for them to say, oh, really, that's your definition of a date? Did you go on a date? Was it a good date? Those questions make sense. If you have no definition of a date, then you can't ever say there are dates, and you can't ever say that there's a good date. And so for me, this is a conceptual tool that helps me illuminate social behavior, and it's analogous to the date situation. I think in both cases, it's legitimate to define it and not inappropriate or, as the critics have said, what, imperialistic or hegemonic to work with the definition. I'm a pragmatist, and I want to be real clear about what tools I'm using and to see what's revealed about social behavior once you use those tools. So my definition, though, for this chapter five, it might be a little unwieldy or complicated, but I hope that as people work through that chapter, that they get some sense of the costs and benefits of different decisions about, as you said, different strategies for defining religion. And I don't know if this comes through, but really my target in that chapter, the definition of religion that I wanted to get away from, is Paul Tillich's. So Paul Tillich defines religion in terms of ultimate concern. And I talk about a bunch of other philosophers, and not just philosophers, but social scientists who have bought into that definition, that which I call a pure functionalist definition. So if you say whatever serves in your life as an orientation, whatever serves in your life to rank your values, whatever serves in your life as your highest concern, your ultimate concern, that's your religion. So a person in this respect, and this was Tillich's goal, right, was to say Nazism could be a demonic religion, and therefore it's at war with other religions. Some of the other philosophers and social scientists I look at talk about money being a person's religion, or even sports, if the person is a super fan, being their religion. And this is the definition of religion I was trying to move away from. I feel like it's not especially helpful for the empirical study of religions, because this means that you could watch a person who regularly attends traditional religious practices, but you don't know whether or not that's their religion, because you don't know if it's their highest concern. And in fact, their band or their sports team or their money or something that one can't tell from observing their behavior, that is their ultimate concern, and that's their religion. I feel like that definition of religion, which I find common among theologians and philosophers of religion, makes conversations with social scientists difficult. It muddies the water. I think it's a poor tool for sorting what's religious from what's not religious. And therefore, my definition of religion includes what I call a substantive element. There has to be some reality that is a religious reality that's present in the definition in order to sort something religious from not religious. The problem is that the previous substantive definitions, the earliest ones I talk about, are if it doesn't have the Christian God, then it's not a religion. Then it's if it doesn't have a supreme God of some kind, that's Herbert's or George Lessing's definition of religion, or maybe it has to have a spiritual being of some kind. Those are the first three stages of substantive definitions. I want to move past those, and I want to have some substantive element that moves my definition away from Tillich's ultimate concern, but is not limited to theistic religions. So my proposal is of super empirical realities, which I define, I hope, carefully enough so that that's a useful concept, which is to say, in order for some phenomenon to qualify as religious for me, it has to have a non-empirical element that is the product of nothing empirical. So somebody might say patriotism is non-empirical, or let's say reverence for the U.S. Constitution. If that's what defines patriotism, that's non-empirical. But the Constitution is a product of people working in a certain place and time, and therefore nationalism or patriotism or following a rock and roll band or following a sports team, none of those things would count as religious for me because they wouldn't be super empirical. On the other hand, the Tao or Brahman or the Logos, those are non-theistic super empirical realities, and so they would count as religious for me. I don't know if people need a new definition of religion, and so people might skip that chapter, but if someone's trying to think through the possibilities, the different ways that religion has been and can be defined, then I hope that chapter is helpful to them.
Yeah, I think you do a good job, and it navigates this fine line of being broad enough and then narrow enough to include the types of things we want to study together. I think you do a very good job.
I'll just interject really quickly.
Yeah.
I find other people, the way you put it was exactly right. I find other people who say, these are the things we want to study. We think Taoism is a religion. We think Buddhism is a religion. So we want to add those to Christianity, let's say, in Islam. But then they despair of finding a way of putting those into a set. They say something like this: religion cannot be defined. There's no element that all those movements have in common. So my proposal is, I don't see myself as simply following conventional ways of speaking where people say, we now say Buddhism is a religion, or we now quote unquote know that Buddhism is a religion or Taoism is a religion. But we just don't know how. I was trying to find a way, a principled way, to sort Buddhism in and being a fan of the Rolling Stones out, or Taoism in but Karl Marx out. And so that's, I guess, the test for that chapter, whether it does a good job with that. And the idea that we know what religion is because people talk that way now, wasn't acceptable to me.
No. So if we have religion based on super empirical realities, this brings in metaphysical claims that you outline many philosophers would question nowadays. So could you tell us about the dilemma of dealing with religious metaphysics in what you call a post-metaphysical age?
Not everything that's super empirical is metaphysical, but some of it is. And I think some of the stuff that's been most interesting to philosophers of religion is metaphysical. So I myself am fascinated by those claims made by members of religious communities that say, we want to talk about something that we think is true always and everywhere. And they're not usually motivated just by wonder or by curiosity about the world. They probably say something like this: we think this particular way of living is the right way, and we want to legitimate that by an appeal to something that we think is true always and everywhere. I mean, here's the analogy. If somebody says, get out of the street, a car is coming, that's a recommendation for action justified with reference to some contingent reality, the car that's coming. But if somebody says, you ought to practice this way of life, not because there's something contingently true here and now, there's something always and everywhere true. Everybody always should have our way of life. That's what I think is the role of metaphysics for religious communities. It's like the ultimate trump card. And so I don't want to exclude them. Sometimes I see people, social scientists, excluding metaphysics because they think there's no way to make sense out of metaphysics. So they say, you know, we're going to treat religion as really a reference to politics, or really a reference to their society, or really a reference to gender, really a reference to class. And they lower, so to speak, the scope of the claims that the religious community is making. They're not always and everywhere. They're just true of this class. So I'm hoping that the rehabilitation of metaphysics that I try to do in Chapter 6 succeeds to the point that those who are not interested in adjudicating metaphysical claims will still say it makes sense to talk about them, and we can see why religious communities care about them. We don't think it's irrational for them to refer that to metaphysical claims.
And the final chapter is really wonderful, and I think that this can certainly be of value to anybody, even if they don't read any other chapter in the book. And what you're doing here is you're kind of outlining where the philosophy of religion fits into the larger study of religion. So you call religious studies a tripartite field. Can you kind of walk us through what your argument is here of where the philosophy of religion fits?
Yeah, thanks for the compliment. When I talk to people in religious studies, you know, when I go to the AAR, when I go to another conference, there does seem to be a lack of clarity about how the different tasks in the field fit together. Sometimes there's a sort of resentment as if, well, my discipline is doing this great stuff, but it's unappreciated, or my discipline does this great stuff. I don't know why people do that other stuff. I think it's uninteresting or maybe irrelevant. And so my goal in that chapter was to draw a map that shows how the different questions that get asked in the field dovetail with each other and feed into each other and connect to each other. And then I sort them into three questions, as you said, a tripartite field. The basic question, you might say the root question, is simply to understand religious phenomena. So the question is something like this: what is it that the people are doing when they do that? You know, what is it that people are doing when they go into a trance, or when they pray, or when they make a sacrifice, or when they circumcise, or whatever the practice or the institution or the belief or the experience is? That's the basic question. It's an interpretive question, right? The scholar's goal is to get some clarity of understanding about what people mean by what they say, what they mean by what they do. So that's a phenomenological or hermeneutic task. And the phenomenology of religion is often criticized. As I said earlier, that I see people squabbling about what belongs in the field. I think phenomenology or hermeneutics is often criticized, but I think it's a necessary step. And if we didn't have it, we wouldn't have any data to work with. And so the only criticism that I want to support of phenomenology of religion or hermeneutics is when those phenomenologists limit religious studies to what they do. And they say the only thing we should do in religious studies is seek to understand people. We shouldn't criticize them. We shouldn't be critical of them. We shouldn't reflect on what they do with categories that they themselves wouldn't accept. That's the argument that I'm not accepting. So for me, the root task, or the basic task, the starting task that gives us our data, is this phenomenological or hermeneutical task of interpreting what people say, what their texts say, what their actions say, so that we have some phenomena to work with. That's stage one. And then, like the letter Y, there's a split, and one can ask two different kinds of questions. One set of questions is explaining that phenomena, and a scholar might say, now that I understand what they mean when they say it, I want to explain why they say it. I have a causal explanation that has to do with brain modularity sometimes, or political ideology sometimes, or infantile neurosis sometimes. I want to explain why people are, why they say what they say, why they do what they do. So that's a separate task, though, from the first one of describing. The first one is non-critical. I just want to understand. And the second one is critical, where the scholar is entitled to seek to explain phenomena and predict phenomena based on categories that the insiders themselves don't have, or if they did have, might not accept. That's one branch of that Y-shaped map of the field. And the other branch of the Y-shaped map of the field is an evaluative one. And that's where the philosophers or ethicists or theologians or whoever wants to ask this evaluative question is asking, is that true? Is it right? So the root basic phenomenological description might say, well, what they mean when they say that God is like this is such and such. And then the philosopher or ethicist or theologian or political theorist or whoever else wants to ask these normative questions wants to know if there's good reasons, not causes as on the other branch of the Y, not on the other critical branch, but reasons. Are there good reasons for holding that it's true that justice is like that, or it's true that morality is like this, or it's true that reality is like this. So as I separate them, there's those three general tasks, but they all fit together with each other in a coherent way, and they can be in conversation with each other. The philosophers of religion who are asking the critical question can also ask the critical question about the social scientists and say, do you have good reasons for your explanations of religion? And the social scientists can ask causal questions about the philosophers. They can say, why you evaluate religions in the way you do can be this history, through this psychology.
Now, Kevin, is there anything that we didn't discuss that you'd like to kind of wrap up our conversation with?
Yeah, maybe. I think a good label, I talk about traditional philosophy of religion being too narrow, as you said, and that it ought to grow to include these other questions. But what we've been talking about for the last hour maybe needs the label philosophy of religious studies in order to distinguish it from philosophy of religion. As I see it, philosophy of religion has three tasks, three axes I talk about. And one of those tasks or axes is this philosophy of religious studies. But I don't know. I invite the listeners to your broadcast to think about this as a legitimate subfield, that the history of religious studies as it's emerged can use or could benefit from more philosophical contributions. And so those people who are philosophically inclined, whether or not they would identify themselves as philosophers, those people who are interested in theories and methods in the study of religion, I don't know, I invite them to ask these kinds of questions and to help us clarify the coherence of our field as a whole, so as to better defend it in the academy and to explain it to our students. Thanks.
Yeah, I think you do a great job, and the last chapter for me really helps me kind of rethink, especially in my teaching, what I'm trying to communicate, how we approach the study of religion. So thank you.
Thanks, Christian.
Yeah. Before I let you go, can you tell us a little bit about what you're working on now, or what kind of things we might see from you in the future?
Oh gosh, I'm so swamped right now. Which is a good thing, although I don't have another book I'm working on, but I'm editing the Blackwell Companion to Religious Diversity, and that should come out in 2015. And I've got papers on religious disagreement and on experience as a category in religion, normativity in religious studies. You know what? people who are interested in my work should follow my page on academia.edu, and I'll post my papers there.
Okay. Sounds good. Well, thank you, Kevin, again. We appreciate you making the time, and thanks for writing this wonderful book.
It was a pleasure, Christian. Thank you for the invitation.
That was my conversation with Kevin Shelbrack about his great new book, Philosophy and the Study of Religions, A Manifesto, published by Wiley Blackwell in 2014. Thanks again for listening to New Books in Religion.